Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, which comes at you every Monday morning with views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. In recognition of Women's History Month, we'll begin our show this morning with a review by Jan Hocken and Joe Clement of the new film Turning Red, about a Chinese-Canadian girl. We'll follow that with a reading by Sharon Grant about the history of the movement for reproductive justice from the perspective of African-American women, and a review by Larry Bolden of the novel Black Cake, about generations of women in a large Jamaican family. To close our show, we'll turn to commentary on the unfolding events in Ukraine. Bill Resnick interviews Jeff Cohen about the racism embedded in Western media coverage of contemporary wars. Bill follows up the interview with a commentary by Norman Solomon about the critical need for nuclear disarmament. Our music today will draw on the rich tradition of women, brown, black, and white, singing in feminist protest over the years, from Anna Chandler singing in 1916 about women's suffrage, to Connie Lim's unofficial anthem of the 2017 Women's March. Our winter fund drive has concluded. Thanks to everyone who has given to keep community radio alive in Portland. If you miss the opportunity to show your support, you can still give by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button. Movie representations too often portray Asian women as exotic, hypersexualized, and submissive. Turning Red, the new Pixar Disney film about a 13-year-old Chinese-Canadian girl, deviates from these stereotypes in its complex story of an awkward adolescent. In their Movie Mole review, Joe Clement and Jan Hocken look at Turning Red through a feminist lens and talk about how the film takes up psychological aspects of girlhood.
Turning Red is the coming-of-age story of Mei Lin Li, or Mei, a 13-year-old high-achieving Chinese-Canadian girl growing up in Toronto in the early 2000s, who struggles with her loving but highly controlling mother. Mei wakes up one day to discover that she now transforms into a magical giant red panda whenever she gets angry or upset. The red panda is an allegory for puberty and for emerging sexual feelings and strivings for independence. Turning Red is the first Pixar film directed by a woman, Chinese-Canadian filmmaker Domi Shi, who co-wrote the screenplay with Julia Cho. Well, Joe, let's start with the Bechdel test in looking at this film, which listeners on the Mole may be familiar with. It was introduced by graphic novelist Alison Bechdel, and it gives three criteria for measuring representations of women in film. First, whether it features at least two women. Second, do they talk to each other? And three, do they talk about something other than men? This perhaps would, on the face of it, certainly meet those criteria. Joe, how would you look at the film from this angle?
Well, these are teenage girls who are obsessed with boys, and in particular, a boy band called 4Town. And a lot of their conversations revolve around that. There's many scenes where they are hanging out and they want to just, now let's look at boys. It's this thing for them to do. But their interest in boys is very much, I think, their own thing. And in a way, it's reflecting their own desire rather than this reflection of male desire to be desired. The men aren't really prominent in the film at all, and in a way are the objects of this female gaze.
And I think the film also is surprising, especially for a Pixar Disney partnership in this project, in not only featuring a female protagonist, but a world that is very much dominated by girls and women and intergenerational struggles, among mother-daughter struggles that cross three generations, and also takes up strivings for independence and the notion of what it means to be a good daughter in relation to your mother. So the wish to also to achieve in school and do well, to become productive as a young immigrant girl is a very dominant theme here, as well as to break free from the control of your parents and the relationships with other girls. Also, don't conform to conventional notions of female desirability or femininity. Her friends kind of have a subversive streak. They're rebellious. They're not conventionally, in the Western Eurocentric way, pretty. And so it's not by any means a tale of girls struggling just to attract the male gaze.
Right? They're like your classic unapologetic dork with personalities that are a mix between wearing your heart on your sleeve and Daria-esque deadpan humor. And they have bodies with shapes. I think to Ming, Mei's mother, they appear to be, like you said, subversive, but just also non-conforming and somehow a liability to Mei's success. And at the beginning of the film, Mei is telling us about her family and how the most important thing in her family is the value of honoring your parents, which is this classical Chinese value of filial piety. And she expresses this in terms of honoring herself. She says that people say, well, be careful, because if you honor your parents, you may not honor yourself, which is prefiguring the whole tension of the story in the film, how those two things can be in conflict. But I think that Mei does have that conflict, but it's not simply black and white where her parents are this oppressive other and she's going to be herself. And when she figures that out, she's going to separate from them. Her parents and her family and all of this overbearing relationship actually has a very functional role to play in building her up as a strong character, as a strong person who is her own person. And it's when she's hitting this age of seeing outside the family as where her identity and desires are that she starts to realize that it's more complicated than that.
I would also like to talk about the theme of menstruation that is still a very subversive and taboo topic. And it was kind of funny to see a Disney female character say, has the peony blossomed? Which was an inquiry her mother made about the start of menstruation. You see the mother coming into the bathroom when she thinks Mei is upset because she started her period, and she brings in all these products and then comes to school, and the over-controlling mother who's there with everything she thinks her daughter is going to need. It was endearingly funny. And it's not seen as a dramatic point. It's kind of a matter-of-fact element of the story, this starting of her period. But as puberty opens up other more threatening desires, impulses, and feelings that destabilize her mother and her plan for her.
And at one point, the mother tries to bring pads to the daughter at school. And this registers that there is still some sort of awkwardness, if not taboo, associated with that because she's embarrassed by this. But what is really going on at this point in the story is that she is turning into a giant red panda and is trying to hide that from her mother, who she doesn't realize knows what it's all about.
Well, let's talk about the red panda image, which of course dominates, and some critics have said it kind of overplays the red panda, and that it represents emotions. It's been described as her messy side, the parts of her that don't fit. I think less of a focus on discussions of the red panda and what it symbolizes in this film is its meaning as a representation of sexual desire, of emerging sexual feelings. What's your take on the red panda as an image that carries this idea of the forbidden, the messy, the out of place parts of girlhood?
Well, the panda is described as being the kind of patron animal of an ancestor of Mei's who is given this power by the gods to harness her emotions and churn into this mystical giant red panda in an ancient setting to ward off bandits when the men have gone to war. And it's passed down to the women through the generations. And when it emerges in Mei, It happens in a moment where her sexual desire for a teenage boy is thwarted by her mother. And when she wakes up in the morning and has turned into this panda, and she rushes into the bathroom and the mother thinks that it's menstruation, that sets up this first association with sexuality. But the red panda also is connected to emotions in a more general way. And so getting angry about things, turning red, has this, you know, multivalent possibility where it's about emotions in a lot of registers: sexuality as a positive emotion, anger as a problematic emotion, embarrassment and shame also are things that we speak of turning red about. And all of these things come together in the panda image. The red panda is described as having been chosen and adored by the ancestor because of its mischievous nature and fiery red coat.
And as her father tells her, red is a very lucky color. So he is on the periphery, but also is affirming of her emerging powers and encourages her not to be afraid of the red panda within. I think the issue of sexuality is perhaps important because it's been an area where the film has been criticized, and actually Pixar and Disney films in the past for toning down on any kind of sexuality or sexual identity that deviates from a heterosexist norm. But this is a film about puberty, which often is a phase of development where girls and boys are allowed more pleasure and sensuality in each other. When the red panda emerges, her other girlfriends embrace her, and there's a lot of touching and affection and just sheer joy in each other's company. And the other girls pet her and touch her. So you can see it as even the fur as a signifier of a certain pleasure that girls can take in one another's company and touching that often is forbidden if it's coded more directly as sexual.
One of the things that I really loved about this film is her relationships with her girlfriends become this kind of key to how she understands having a kind of control. And control isn't the right word, because what she's really doing is getting beyond controlling her feelings, but embracing them.
And not being frightened of parts of her that feel too powerful or strong.
Yeah, it's not even like they're causing problems, but it's really the resistance to them that can create the problems. And what happens is she goes to this place in her mind. Her friends have like given her something that she has taken inside as far as a sense of secure attachment with them, and that they always have her back, and that this, rather than some kind of individual willpower or just strategy of subordinating your feelings to something else, is what gives her the ability to turn the panda on and off. By reaching out to others and by having friendships and relationships that support you, you are able to be yourself. You are able to feel better about yourself by having those in your life. And this contrasts with a nihilism that's very typical of youth, that you can't trust anybody. Now, that said, May's attachment to her mother is a very important part of how she grows up, but it is, you know, a dysfunctional attachment. It comes with a lot of baggage for her. It's sown with a lot of Ming's insecurities. And at one point, she tells her mother that she's able to control the panda, because they test her on this, because she just thinks of the people that she loves the most. And her mother automatically assumes, oh, she means me, but really she means her friends. And I think this is a powerful suggestion for kids, that as you're growing up and you are feeling these new big feelings and you're trying to make sense of who you are, that if you don't feel safe with your parents because of how their own insecurities repeat themselves in you, as much as you may love them for all the ways they have taken care of you, that by building these relationships with new people and friends, you will get through that, and you have the possibility of growing up and from that place being able to connect and repair with these first relationships that sometimes give us so much trouble.
So this is Jan Hocken and Joe Clement talking today about the film by Dummy Shi, Turning Red. I think the portrayal of friendships and even the coming to terms with the boys in a group and this teen girl group of friends is important when you look at the context of how much adolescence is pathologized in the dominant culture. Teens are seen as wild in their emotions, as psychotic if they were a different stage of development. There's a long history of pathologizing adolescence, pre-adolescence, and assuming that kids at that age are just readily go off the rail. And here, it's not at all a mean girl scene. You know, these are girls that support each other. And I think the fact that the film was produced by a group of women who recalled the supportive role that other girls and women had in their lives made it a kind of both a wish and a fulfillment of ways that girls and women can come to terms with each other, support each other, and that surging impulses and strivings for even power are not in and of themselves pathological. It's how much you find ways of connecting with others. The Red Panda, in a certain way, I think, carries this idea of our desires and impulses as always object seeking, in the sense that they involve desire to connect with others, even sexual feelings, as well as other emotions that humans experience tend to be oriented toward connection with others. And the film deals very effectively, I think, with some of those psychological motifs.
This has been Joe Clement and Jan Hawken, Movie Moles for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking about Turning Red, a new and very worthwhile film to see through Disney Plus, if you have it. Watch for it to come out on DVD. Maybe it'll be at the library once that happens. What you can find at the library right now about Turning Red are some great youth novelizations and other books that will tell the whole story for your kids.
You don't own me, I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me, don't say I can't go with other boys. And don't tell me what to do, don't tell me what to say, and please, when I go out with you.
That was a clip from the 1963 classic by Leslie Gore, which I was listening to as a teenager while dancing with my girlfriends. At its inception, the mainstream women's movement for reproductive rights in this country was confined to the right to have an abortion. Black and brown women challenged that narrow concept with the broader idea of reproductive justice, including the right to bear children. Sharon Grant reads excerpts from an article by Kianga Yamada Taylor entitled, How Black Feminists Defined Abortion Rights. As liberation movements bloomed, Taylor argues, they offered a vision of reproductive justice that was about equality, not just choice.
This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And as this is Women's History Month, I'll be reading excerpts from How Black Feminists Define Abortion Rights, : as liberation movements bloomed, they offered a vision of reproductive justice that was about equality, not just choice. It's by Kianga Yamada Taylor, printed in the February 22, 2022 New Yorker magazine. Taylor begins this way. It will probably be months before the Supreme Court decides in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization whether to overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 Supreme Court decision that affirmed the constitutional right to abortion. But in this latest round of attacks on Roe, a novel line of argument has emerged, contending that forced pregnancy and parenthood no longer constitute a hardship for women. Lawyers representing Mississippi, the appellant in the lawsuit, describe a world that has fundamentally changed over the past 50 years, in which the burdens of parenting have been lifted and women have been empowered to have it all, to assume a career while still raising families. In an interview with a local television station, the Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch added, quote, 50 years ago for professional women, they wanted you to make a choice. Now you don't have to. Now you have the opportunity to be whatever you want to be. You have the option in life to really achieve your dreams, your goals, and you can have those beautiful children as well, unquote. That Dobbs originates in Mississippi, the poorest state in the country, twists this fairy tale into a cruel joke. In Mississippi, nearly half of women-led households live in poverty, almost twice the national average. 12% of women in the state lack health insurance, compared with 8% nationally. And because this case is no longer just about Mississippi, it also ignores the fact that Black women are 3 to 4 times more at risk of dying in childbirth than white women. For poor and working class women, a disproportionate number of whom are Black and Brown, overturning Roe won't mean that abortions will end. It will mean that safe and sound abortions in healthcare facilities will move further out of reach. One study found that 80% of deaths caused by septic abortions in New York City in the 1960s involved Black and Puerto Rican women. In Georgia, between 1965 and 1967, the Black maternal death rate was 14 times that of white women. In Roe, the Supreme Court claimed to want to make a dispassionate decision, one not influenced by the larger debates concerning abortion. Quote, population growth, pollution, poverty, and racial overtones tend to complicate and not to simplify the problem, end quote, Justice Blackmun wrote. In this way, the court's decision reflected the narrowness of the mainstream women's movement, which viewed abortion as the singular way to measure women's rights to control their reproductive lives. Black, Puerto Rican, and Chicana women had different constraints and burdens in their daily lives that meant they would have different approaches to achieving liberation. The chasm between middle-class white women's demands and aspirations and those of poor and working-class women of color began to be addressed by the emergence of Black feminists in the late 60s. These women, who included Toni Cade Bambara, Frances Beale, Alice Walker, and Barbara Smith, argued that real equality could be achieved only by expanding the parameters of what constituted reproductive justice to include the entire context within which decisions about having or not having children were made. For Black feminists, many of whom had become radicalized through their involvement in the civil rights movement, the persistent racism and sexism that they experienced compelled them to question the totality of American society, not just their place in it. In 1969, Frances Beale penned one of the pioneering documents of Black feminism, a pamphlet titled Double Jeopardy, to be Black and Female. Beale wrote, quote, it is idle dreaming to think of Black women simply caring for their homes and children like the middle class white model. Most Black women have to work to help house, feed, and clothe their families. By the time Beale wrote Double Jeopardy, she and several other Black women in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, were leaving the group because of increasingly divergent ideas about the role of women in the Black movement. As Beale wrote, quote, to assign women the role of housekeeper and mother while men go forth into battle is a highly questionable doctrine for a revolutionary to maintain. Those who consider themselves to be revolutionary must begin to deal with other revolutionaries as equals. And so far as I know, revolutionaries are not determined by sex, end quote. This was more than a debate over the women in radical politics. Beale and her women comrades were chafing against the influence of Daniel Patrick Moynihan's 1965 report on the state of the Black family. Quote, at the center of the tangle of pathology is the weakness of the family structure. Once or twice removed, it will be found to be the principal source of most of the aberrant, inadequate, or antisocial behavior that did not establish but now serves to perpetuate the cycle of poverty and deprivation, end quote. In a speech a year after this report was published, the SNCC leader Stokely Carmichael said, quote, "To set the record straight, the reason we are in a bag we are in isn't because of my mama, it's because of what they did to my mama. We have to put the blame where it belongs," end quote. For Beale and other Black feminists, reproductive freedom, including access to birth control and abortion, and the right to have children on their terms, was the most basic element of self-determination in a society where their choices were heavily circumscribed by racism, gender, and class position. As a result, Black women activists not only took up the immediate questions concerning reproduction, but they also raised issues about childcare, employment, welfare, and the other material necessities that could help women take care of their children and choose to bring them into the world. By focusing on the plight of poor women, they made it easier to see that the struggle for abortion and reproductive freedom was about equality, not just privacy or even choice. Their insights into the ways that poverty and other forms of oppression limited their life chances compelled them to demand reproductive justice. It's a standard that certainly was not achieved with Roe, but is needed now more than ever. This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour, reading excerpts from the article, How Black Feminists Defined Abortion Rights, printed in the February 22nd, 2022 New Yorker magazine.
I hear these women raving about their monkey men, about their fighting husbands and their no good friends. These poor women sit around all day and moan, wondering why their wandering papas don't come home. But while women don't worry, while women don't have the blues.
The music you just heard was from Wild Women Don't Have the Blues by Ida Cox, recorded in 1924. It's about how a powerful and assertive woman keeps her man in check. Before that, Sharon Grant read from an article by Kianga Yamada Taylor entitled How Black Feminists Defined Abortion Rights. You can find a link to the article on our webpage at kboo.fm. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We now turn to a history of women's lives in Jamaica, as illustrated by a multi-generational story about a Jamaican family. Book mole Larry Bolden reviews the novel Black Cake, by Charmaine Wilkerson. Standing in for Larry this morning is yours truly. Black Cake is a sprawling, brilliant debut novel by Charmaine Wilkerson. It's hard to believe it's a debut novel since the writing is so rich and complex, but she's been writing for a long time. Benedetta Bennett, known as Benny, and Coventina Covey have been best friends for life, and their voices are two of the most important narrative voices in this novel, although there are a host of narrators representing generations of families. The chapters are split between then, 1965, and now, 2018. Benny and Byron, once super close siblings, have drifted apart as they matured, but the death of their mother, Eleanor Bennett, brings them together again. The narrative she has left behind for them shows that Eleanor was not the person they or others thought she was. Benny and Byron, or B&B as their mother liked to call them, have been summoned to Eleanor Bennett's attorney's office and are given a handwritten note and a USB drive. The note says simply, "B&B, there's a small black cake in the freezer for you. Don't throw it out." As Wilkerson tells us in her author's note, It was my personal familiarity with a particular Caribbean food, black cake, that led obliquely to this book. It started me thinking about the emotional weight carried by recipes and other familial markers that are handed down from one generation to the next. Then it had me writing about characters who must hold fast to their sense of self when they learn their lives have been built on a dubious narrative. End quote. What we call holiday fruitcake is as close as most of us come to black cake. But the Caribbean black cake is made with fruit that has been soaked in alcohol over long periods of time and is especially treasured as a wedding cake. Here again from the author's notes. Not everyone sits down to write a book, but everyone is a storyteller in one form or other. As I wrote this novel, a lifetime of anecdotes and fleeting impressions shared by the Caribbean members of my multicultural family helped me to develop some of the fictional characters and scenarios from the 1950s and 1960s. The scenes from the unnamed island in the Caribbean reflect some of the geography and history of Jamaica. The fictional town, where members of the book's older generation grew up, is inspired by the northeast coast of that island and uses a mix of actual and invented locations. End of quote. Without telling you much of the story that unfolds as B&B listen to the story their mother tells them, Covey, Benny's best friend, is given by her father as a bride to a much older and powerful moneylender. Benny, who is a great long-distance swimmer, helps Covey to escape the island and the marriage, but must then escape and change her own identity because of the long reach of the moneylender and his family. While B&B slowly learned the real history of their mother, scores of other characters are introduced. Covey eventually becomes a kind of food anthropologist, telling family stories via food traditions. Benny becomes a world-famous open-water distance swimmer and eventually marries and moves to the United States. In many ways, Wilkerson displays the dangers for blacks living in white communities, and in this way, the novel seems very current. A black man is pulled over for a busted taillight, and while trying to get his wallet, the officer pulls a gun on him. Quote, "What was the kid supposed to do if he was asked to show his driver's license? How is a person supposed to reach for their wallet? Are black people in America not allowed to have hands?" Byron would like to believe that this epidemic of mistreatment, this bullying of unarmed black men, is just that, an outbreak, though prolonged, that can be brought under control. He wants to keep believing in law enforcement officers, to respect the risky work that they do, knowing that every day they step into unknown territory. He wants to know that he can still pick up the phone and call the cops if he ever needs to. There's a lot of anger out there, a lot of hurt. Where are they all going to end up? Black, white, whoever, if things don't get better. End quote. Good question. And Wilkerson is a master at spotlighting this and so many contemporary issues. This is a wonderful novel, one of the best I have read in the past 2 years, and a fitting tribute to Women's History Month. I have been talking about Charmaine Wilkerson's 2022 novel, Black Cake. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I am Patricia Kullberg, reading today for Larry.
What am I not supposed to have an opinion? Should I keep quiet just because I'm a woman? Call me a bitch, cause I speak what's on my mind. Guess it's easier for you to swallow if I sat and smile. When a female fires back, suddenly the target don't know how to act. So guess what that little boy would do? Making up a few false promises too. That for sure is not a man to be. It's smattering names for popularity. He says you only get to be through controversy. But now it's time for me to come and give you more to say.
That was a clip from Can't Hold Us Down by Christina Aguilera. with rapper Lil' Kim, released in 2003. Before that, we heard a book review by Larry Bolden of the recent novel Black Cake. We now turn to our ongoing commentary on the war in Ukraine. First up, Bill Resnick interviews Jeff Cohen about U.S. media coverage of the Russian invasion as compared to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Cohen points out that civilian deaths in Ukraine, for example, are shown in heartbreaking detail, while civilian deaths in Iraq, where Cohen was a war reporter, went largely ignored. Here's Bill.
Hi, Jeff Cohen. Welcome to KABU.
Nice to be with you.
Jeff Cohen founded and directed the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. He also co-founded the organization's Roots Action, as well as FAIR. That's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a magazine and website that's really useful. He's the author of Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. So, Jeff Cohen, you recently published an article on the website Common Dreams, title, This is What It Looks Like When the Corporate Media Opposes a War. The subtitle is Major American Media Outlets Oppose Military Aggression Unless the United States is Doing It. You might have expanded that subtitle, that establishment media oppose military intervention to overthrow elected governments, and they are horrified when civilians, especially children, are killed by the interventions. Except, of course, unless the United States is doing it, that is, doing the overthrowing and killing. Jeff, tell us the story of the disparate treatment, first of civilian casualties and disparate treatment in major media of civilian casualties, and then we can get to U.S. imperialist overthrow of other governments.
Yeah, well, I speak as someone who worked in cable news, mainstream TV news, until 3 weeks before the invasion of Iraq, and I was terminated along with Phil Donahue because we were skeptical of the proposed invasion of Iraq, and we were terminated 3 weeks before that invasion for political reasons. So trust me, I know the mainstream media from the inside. Anyone who watches U.S. mainstream media knows that when the U.S. is the aggressor, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Iraq, whether it's the invasion of Panama, huge numbers of civilians have been killed. And in the mainstream media, when the U.S. military is doing the killing, that cannot be covered. We know that memos leaked out from CNN that were sent by management to every CNN anchor and correspondent at the beginning of the invasion of Afghanistan, telling them that they had to, if they ever acknowledged that civilians were being killed in Afghan by U.S. forces, it had to be excused. The viewers had to be repeatedly reminded that this is in retaliation for 9/11. Trust me, a few weeks after 9/11, no one had forgotten it. But there was always this effort to rationalize and excuse or ignore civilian casualties. It's horrific what Russia is doing in Ukraine today. They are killing civilians. They are terrorizing women who are about to give birth. They're terrorizing whole communities. But the United States did the same thing in Iraq in March of 2003 with an aerial campaign, a bombardment that was far more severe, killed far more civilians than the Russians have killed in Ukraine, killed far more children. I mean, the bombing of Baghdad and other cities in Iraq was perhaps the most massive bombing campaign in global history, but the U.S. media did not cover civilians. Thousands and thousands of children were killed, thousands of civilians in the first 3 weeks. There's the belief that 7,000 civilians had been killed by the U.S. That was an illegal war. You know, that was a violation of international law. It was endorsed by the Oregonian in an editorial. President Bush has built a strong case for the invasion of Iraq, unquote. It was endorsed by mainstream media. Television news ignored the civilian casualties in other countries. They were covering all the civilians in Iraq that were killed. They had huge numbers of refugees. It's estimated that in the first months a huge number of doctors and nurses had fled Iraq and what had been one of the most advanced healthcare systems in that part of the world became one of the worst healthcare systems because of the U.S. aerial bombardment and war. Why was the U.S. invasion of Iraq just as illegal as the Russia invasion of Ukraine? Because military force by one country against another is illegal unless authorized by the United Nations Security Council or you're acting in pure self-defense. The United States did not get an authorization from the UN Security Council. It was every bit as criminal as the current Russian invasion of Ukraine, but the mainstream media never pointed that out in our country. They did in other countries.
Yeah, that's true. I think one thing we have to recognize, the killing of civilians by the U.S. is not confined just to U.S. forces. We contract out killings. We have the School of the Americas, for example, that trains the militaries all over Latin America. That is those who still do it. Some have broken with the U.S. on that. And we control the militaries, giving them arms all over the world, military bases also all over the world. The killings of civilians by, if the U.S. wanted to, it could in many of those cases, most of them stop the killing. And they clearly don't, nor does the U.S. media cover it. The best case now is Yemen. Tell us about that, Jeff Cohen.
Well, in Yemen, which is a huge humanitarian problem where for 7 years people are starving because of the Saudi Arabia-United Arab Emirates war, which the U.S. has been supporting and is supporting up till this day. But again, that does not get covered by U.S. mainstream media. You mentioned a lot of civilian casualties that the U.S. is responsible for in Latin America. Clearly, if you look at the U.S. overthrow, I found it curious to watch a host on MSNBC talking about Russian imperialism, but you can never talk about U.S. imperialism. You know, Russia has 20 military bases in a half a dozen foreign countries. The United States has nearly 800 foreign military bases in about 80 countries. The U.S. is responsible for 80% of the weapons shipments, military arms sent to other countries. And in Latin America, when there have been often democratically elected governments, but they were progressive ones, like Guatemala in 1954, Chile in 1973, the U.S. has been responsible for military coups that have led to thousands of assassinations and civilian deaths. And in Guatemala and El Salvador, you know, for decades, U.S. surrogates and militaries armed and trained by the U.S. engaged in massive killings of civilians that just did not get the U.S. mainstream media coverage. The only civilians where the U.S. mainstream media has been focused, and civilians should always be the main focus of modern warfare, it's been the Russia invasion of Ukraine, and that's why I call it hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy on steroids. Yeah, it's really remarkable when you, and it's over and over and over in every network, and they use a lot of the same footage anyway.
Let me say, Bill, yesterday I was watching MSNBC and Nicole Wallace. She asked the question, how are we ever going to bring the leaders of Russia to hold them accountable for the crimes they are committing and Putin? And Nicole Wallace was a top aide to President Bush when the U.S. did its illegal invasion of Iraq, and then she soon became the communications director of the White House. So I'm looking at this kind of hypocrisy where the U.S. media is accurately today referring to and covering and focusing on civilian trauma, but the U.S. mainstream media looked away from civilian trauma whenever the United States military was the culprit.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Jeff Cohen, a journalist and talk journalism. Writes a lot critiquing U.S. media. Early in his career, he worked at CNN, got fired along with Phil Donahue for critiquing the invasion of Iraq when CNN, like the rest of establishment media, was engaged in whipping up enthusiastic public support for the Iraq war. and ignoring the vast number of civilian deaths and probably the worst massacre from the air in world history. We just discussed how U.S. media grieve, show heartbreaking pictures of civilians, especially children, when they're killed by Russia. But for the killings done by the U.S. or by U.S.-trained armies and death squads in service to U.S. foreign policy goals, killed by the millions. For example, in Indonesia, no one talks about 2 million Chinese who were killed under the Suharto government with the connivance of the United States. Those people are just treated basically as collateral damage. It's necessary to protect democracy. Didn't you know that, Jeff?
Yeah.
Jeff, let's pivot now to the overthrow of governments, fairly elected governments or not, who fail to accept U.S. guidance. I remember in high school, we read a good deal about the Monroe Doctrine, the U.S. Manifest Destiny. It was taught as sort of self-evidently true, the great United States has to rule the world. That we're a democracy who invented the idea of human rights that must be protected. Tell us about that aspect of U.S. media.
Yeah, U.S. media did not cover the coups against democratically elected government that led to right-wing military dictatorships with anything like the scrutiny we're getting about civilian toll today in Ukraine. I'm not criticizing today's coverage of the civilian casualties in Ukraine. Foregrounded in all wars and all military coups should be the civilians. But the U.S. overthrew a democratically elected government in Guatemala in 54, in Chile in 73, in Honduras in 2009. In Honduras, it was President Obama in power and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And it was a progressive government that had been democratically elected in Honduras. And every government in Western Hemisphere immediately denounced that military coup in Honduras, except for one government. And that was the U.S. government led by Obama and Hillary Clinton. So, yes, there's been a lot of bloodshed caused in the Western Hemisphere when the U.S. intervened against democratic governments in favor of right-wing military regimes. But how many people in this country know about the assassinations of indigenous leaders, of feminist leaders, of environmental leaders in Honduras that happened in 2009, 2010, because the U.S. government is the one in our hemisphere that made sure that the coup regime stayed in power?
Yeah, it's a terrible story. And this guy Zelaya, the president who was spirited out of the country and dropped, I think, in Santo Domingo or somewhere. It turned out he was himself from a plantation family. He was basically a social democrat. He wanted a little bit more money from the banana companies to go to the people and workers. And that was much too much for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, President Zelaya was very much like a Franklin Delano Roosevelt figure. He was a figure of the elite, but he came into power and he was trying to transfer some wealth to working class and poor people in Honduras, and he was overthrown by a military government. The U.S. didn't cause the coup, but they caused the coup regime to stay in power when every other government in Western Hemisphere was trying to get that coup regime out of power. How do we know? Well, we know from WikiLeaks that a memo was sent immediately from after the military coup happened from the U.S. Embassy in Honduras to Hillary Clinton in Washington at the State Department saying, open and shut case, this is an illegal coup. But the U.S. leadership, Obama, Hillary Clinton, they said they needed to do more investigation. They weren't sure what had happened. It's a sickening modern example of how U.S. foreign policy has killed so many innocent civilians. And Honduras is very unknown by even very astute and constant viewers and readers of U.S. mainstream media. It just was rarely covered.
Jeff Cohen, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
Right. So long.
No man is greater than his mother. No man is
boys have sold. No man is better than the wife he loves. Her love will guide him, whatever betide him. He's good enough to love you and adore you. He's good enough to bear your troubles for you. And if your tears were falling today, nobody else would kiss them away. He's good enough to warm your heart with kisses when you are lonesome and blue. He's good enough to be your baby's mother, and he's good enough to vote with you.
That was a ragtime recording of a song about voting rights for women from 1916 by Anna Chandler. Before that, Bill Resnick was talking with Jeff Cohen about the distortions of war reporting in the Western media. And now to close our show, Bill Resnick joins us again for a reading from an article by KBOO alumnus Norman Solomon, which is titled, Now is the Time for a Global Movement Demanding Nuclear De-escalation. It was published on March 3, 2022 by Truthout.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole with one of our occasional features, A Well-Read Red. It was written by Norman Solomon, first published by the website Truthout. The piece is titled, Now is the Time for a Global Movement Demanding Nuclear De-escalation. Norman is a KBOO alumnus and nationally syndicated columnist, published a lot in the left press and sometimes in the major national establishment newspapers. Here's Norman on nuclear de-escalation. President Joe Biden spoke 6,500 words during the State of the Union speech Tuesday night. Not one of them acknowledged the dangers of nuclear war that have spiked upward during the last decade and even more steeply in recent days. The militarism that Martin Luther King Jr. warned us about has been spiraling towards its ultimate destination in the nuclear era, a global holocaust that would likely extinguish almost all human life on Earth. In the midst of this reality, leaders of the world's two nuclear superpowers continue to fail and betray humanity. The phrase narrow nationalism aptly describes the nuclear weapons policies of the United States and Russia. They have been engaged in a dance of death with foreseeable human consequences on a scale that none of us can truly fathom. Einstein expressed the belief that informed citizenry will act for life and not death. But the dire nuclear trends have been enabled by citizenry uninformed and inactive. By killing the ABM, the Ballistic Missile Treaty, and the INF agreements, the Intermediate Missile Treaty, the U.S. government pushed the world further away from nuclear arms control, let alone disarmament. And by insisting on expansion of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that's NATO, to Russia's borders, and in recent months continuing to insist that Ukrainian membership in NATO should stay on the table, the United States ignored Russia's longstanding and reasonable concerns about NATO expansion. Overall, NATO's claims of being a defensive alliance have been undercut by three decades of broken promises, as well as intensive war operations in Serbia, Afghanistan, and Libya. Russia, of course, has its own military-industrial complex and nationalistic fervor. The duplicity and provocations by the United States and its NATO allies do not in the slightest justify the invasion of Ukraine that Russia launched a week ago. Russia is now on a murderous killing spree, no less abhorrent than what occurred from the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Last week, the extreme recklessness of Russian President Vladimir Putin's not-so-veiled threat to use nuclear weapons was an indication of just how dangerous the Ukraine conflict has gotten. For everyone, everywhere. Passivity will get us nowhere. In the U.S., supporting anti-war protests, demanding real diplomacy while organizing for peace, they're essential. But we're not hearing anything from Congress or the White House about taking steps to reduce the chances of nuclear war. Instead, we're hearing jacked-up rhetoric about confronting Russia. It's all too clear that responsible leadership will not come from official Washington, It must come from grassroots activism with determined organizing and political pressure. Realistic hope seems to be in very short supply right now, but at this dire moment, all that we love demands our determination to organize. That was Norman Solomon on the need for a vast movement for nuclear de-escalation. I want to conclude with one dispute with Norman's thesis. He argues that the Ukraine war is the product of narrow nationalisms of the U.S. and Russia. But that doesn't capture what's at stake, the goals of the two parties. Because this war brought on by NATO expansionism arises from the U.S. drive for supremacy that is now only countered by Russia and China seeking a bipolar or multipolar world. The U.S. wants a unipolar world. As the U.S. keeps encroaching on both Russia and China's sphere of influence, they're fighting back and refusing to accept the new world order run by the U.S. They understandably refuse to be vassals, having to accept military dominance of the U.S., which translates into political and economic domination. And with that domination, they will assume domination of space. If we can avoid nuclear war this time, China and the U.S. are developing space weapons, and some sort of nuclear rattling is bound to come. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, bringing you Norman Solomon's piece in Truth Out, first published by the website Truth Out. The piece is, now is the time for a global movement demanding nuclear de-escalation.
Thanks, Bill. A link to the article will be posted on our webpage at kboo.fm. That's it for our show today. Thanks to Moles Jan Hocken, Joe Clement, Sharon Grant, Larry Bolden, and Bill Resnick, and our guest this morning, Jeff Cohen. Editing Mole, John Nelson, also contributed to today's show. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been your host. We also want to thank the staff and the board of directors at KBOO for their hard work and dedication. If you like what you hear, please support us by going to kboo.fm and donating today. I'd like to leave you this morning with one last song, the unofficial anthem of the 2017 Women's March in Washington, D.C. Entitled Quiet, the song was written and recorded by Connie Lim in 2015. Catch the Old Mole again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-colonial perspective. In the meantime, stay safe and stay active.
Put on your face, know your place, shut up and smile, don't spread your legs. I could do that, but no.